Welcome back, poppies, to yet another episode of Brain Pops, episode 34 already. Brain Pops, obviously the podcast approaching mental and physical challenges behind the scenes of professional sports. My name is Dominic Theodoro. I just want to say hi from Bamberg again. And obviously this podcast would be nothing without the often copied but never equaled Lennart Stechmann. Lennart, hey, how are you?
Hey Dom, how are you doing? I'm doing great. Thanks for this kind invitation intro to this podcast.
Yeah, you know, I had like 5 weeks of time at least in order to come up with something that would suit you. That's why I hope you liked my introduction today. But Lennart, please pick us up.
Today we really make our introduction work, let's say. Because today we bring together those two expertise in our guests. But maybe, Dom, like she was nominated by Stefan Dahl and you made this possible. Big shout out to you in Bamberg for doing this, for organizing this. And maybe you can also introduce her real quick.
Yeah, I'll just make it short because last time I thought we, you know, have to make that like a little... I don't know that we have to bring it up in a way as this would be a surprise, but everybody knows, of course, who's the guest already. We have Julia Eyre as our guest today, and she's a soccer strength coach and also a soccer sports psychologist. So we're going to touch on some topics that we probably have not really touched upon yet, and I think it's going to be a fun episode.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what I meant with... like the introduction, we combine both today, like the mental and the body part, let's say, of the professional sports. So with no further ado, I would say let's jump into the episode. See you in a bit.
Welcome back. We are live and we have Julia with us. Hey, Julia, how are you?
I am doing really well. How are you, Dom?
I'm not too bad. Also, Lennart is obviously also with you. Lennart, hey, what's going on?
Yes, Dom. Hey, how are you? And how are you, Julia? Thanks for being us and for craving out the time.
I am really excited. Thanks, guys, for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be talking to you guys after having communicated in the DMs. Dom slid into the DMs a couple months ago, and we got to know each other. We have many mutual friends, it seems. And the sports world is a very large world, but also a very small one. So I'm glad we finally got to connect.
Yeah, and a big shout out, of course, at this point to Stefan Dahl for nominating you.
Yes.
Exactly. Thank you, Stefan. Julia, yeah, why don't you pick us up a little bit, tell us a little bit what you're doing, how you became a coach, for example. Just take us on a ride.
I don't know what I'm doing. It would be great if you knew what I was doing so you could tell me what to do. but I will try my best. Yeah, so I'm Julia. I'm American and German, equal parts. We'll see how much you guys can hear on either side of the mic throughout this podcast. I am a sports scientist, strength coach, and a psychologist. I'm not a sports psychologist. I don't have that particular set of skills, but I'm a studied psychologist. And I work in the sports industry, among other places and other things. I have my own company, White Lion Performance, where after leaving the college world, the college setting, I moved into... yeah, basically being my own boss and taking sports science on the road and trying to make education in sports science what is usually really complex, and sports scientists like it to be complex because then it's very exclusive, but making it more accessible to athletes themselves so they can advocate for themselves, which then actually came from, of course, being an athlete and injuring myself so badly that I needed to end my career and trying to discover, you know, what is this whole rehab thing about and how do we deal with injuries and how do we basically optimize performance in the long term so that athletes can, yeah, be peak performers for as long as they want to consistently across time and have the longest career they can. And then realizing pretty quickly that the physicality of it all, like physical qualities, strength and speed, weren't everything, especially not with speed. It actually is the nervous system, which then led me to psychology and neuroscience. And that's what I wound up doing my next bachelor's and master's in. And then I studied at the Sporthochschule in Köln, which is the biggest sports university in Europe. I'm sure every German knows that. But for anybody listening internationally, it's it is the sport university in Germany. Yeah, everybody knows it, whether it's notorious for a good or bad way. Everybody knows it here in the sports world. And yeah, and now I'm in Gießen after moving around a bit, doing some internships in and around Germany, decided to stay in Germany. I'm quite happy here. I still work a lot in the States, as well as in England, a couple of other countries as well. It's nice to have worldwide connections, but now I'm a psychologist and a sports scientist here locally for TSG. What else is, that's weird to say it in English, TSG Wiesek, here a big youth academy for footballers or soccer players here in the middle of Germany. And as I said, keeping worldwide connections alive and having a lot of fun making education and hard science accessible to athletes so they know what to do with it themselves.
Well, interesting.
Awesome. So a lot of topics we can touch on today.
I've done a few things. I have a few interests.
But I have to say, Leonard, one thing which I find kind of interesting, I tend to hear it more often, you know, that coaches become coaches because sort of they injured themselves before in their own career. Mm-hmm. That is, if I may ask, what area of your body did you injure?
Yeah, so I had the classic left knee injury. I was a soccer player and a swimmer, and it just was classic overuse, had a lot of stress in my life. And again, it doesn't lay entirely on physical qualities. It's not just about the physicality of it all. When the body has stress, the body has to react to that and deal with it. And when it's not dealt with, especially chronic stress, it comes out somewhere. And I badly messed up my left knee and just couldn't play anymore, and also mentally couldn't play anymore either. So my one of my mentors in college who wound up helping me big times into the research world as a woman in research and sports science and psychology told me that I needed to stop freaking out about what I'm going to do with my life. Because at that point I had several major changes and career changes and wasn't an athlete anymore and was injured and whatever. And she said, Julia, stop freaking out. We always study what we are. It's me search. A lot of times it's me search. So don't stress yourself out so much. The research is me search. You'll figure it out. And I think that's true for a lot of coaches, but it's definitely true for a lot of psychologists, that we are very curious about humans, how humans work. Researchers are very curious about our research questions. We defend it very strongly when we have a research question or a research topic. We're very hard behind it. And that's what makes us so irritating a lot of times, because we're so staunch about our opinions and our beliefs and defend our research so strongly, even if it's completely wrong. Because we always study who we are. And that's been my experience for the most part in sport.
Yeah, that fits great into this podcast. Because, I mean, we talked about Dom's story on how he wanted to become a coach. Like our idea behind this podcast is maybe to like have athletes have some, we call it brain pops, some like new input, something that kind of twists their way of thinking a little bit, that they can maybe... you said it in research, but maybe change the way of thinking just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the main motivation behind this. And maybe to give a small outline, what we're trying to do, like first we're going to look a little bit more into training, right, Dom? You have some topics that you're really interested, I think. And then we're going to also try to take a little bit of a dive into the mental, the psychology of performances in sports. So,
I have one question before we start. You said you have your own company, White Lion Performance. What I really would like to know, how did you come up with that name?
So white lions actually exist. They're an endangered species, but it's literally a genetic mutant of a lion and it comes out white. It's literally just an albino lion. And I thought that when I'm working with a lot of athletes, the athletes who really want access to that information, who want to advocate for themselves, who want something different, they might be similar and look similar to, you know, the classic courageous lion athlete, oh, the hero of the story, but they're just built different. Like they're just genetically, they have something different about them that makes them a little bit different. And so if you're going to stand out, it's okay to, you know, be obvious about it. I'm weird. I'm a really strange coach and a really strange psychologist. And if you look at my Instagram, I don't work conventionally at all. And the White Lion Performance is, lion is very special to, like, that's my spirit animal, and very special to me as like a symbol for strength and courage and pushing on and bravery, etc. It's also the king of the jungle. And so when they're built a little bit differently, they're pretty dangerous. So that's where White Lion comes from.
Dom, when we were living together, I remember you having a lion as your background of your laptop always.
Yeah,
so
it
I guess you would agree with that,
I
right?
I still have it though.
Okay, see?
I have one hanging on my wall. Four of them, actually. So, good. We're in the right clan then.
All right. Julia, yeah, I wanted to talk to you about one topic I always find very interesting. You hear it a lot also on social media. You can actually, yeah, there are also some training books you can buy, not just regarding that topic, but it always pops up. It's the topic of buy-in. How coaches can create buy-in with their athletes. And I wanted to hear your opinion or maybe perspective on it, what you consider as buy-in, and how you try to get buy-in from your athletes.
Mm-hmm. I think the most common discussion at the moment about buy-in is the relationship between the coach and the athletes and the communication between them. And for me, a lot of it comes down to the distribution of responsibility. Let's put it that way. I've had experiences with the concept of building buy-in and conscious coaching and Brett Bartholomew's work and the art of coaching.
Yep.
With archetypes of athletes and how important it is to connect with athletes. And interestingly enough, I've never really had a problem with that. Like there's one or two athletes where it's kind of difficult to connect with them. It takes some time. But once you've earned their respect, I've never had a problem with the concept of buy-in. For me, getting it, it's more about like, there's buy-in in the long term and buy-in in the short term. So how do we motivate an athlete who might be bought into future success to doing the small steps? So I see it as kind of breaking it down as opposed to buy-in as a gigantic concept of how do I get you to basically do this work because you're invested mm-hmm. in it, to also how do I make you value this tiny little step? And that comes down to, I don't want to take the responsibility over for that for them. It's their responsibility, and I'm happy to guide them as a colleague, as a coach, as a helper, as a guide. And so I ask them basically before every session, at least once a week, if not more, set a goal for this session, set a goal for this week, and then give me one thing that you're going to do. Like, what is one step that you're going to do to achieve that goal right now? Like, what is the practical step? And so by the time they've written it down, because it's their goal, it's personal to them, it's specific to them, it's not a team goal, it's not the coach's goal. What's your goal? What's the one thing you're going to do in this training session or in this game that you want to achieve? And what's the step you're going to take to even get there? So now I've already got their buy-in because they committed two things. This is what I want, and this is what I'll do for it. That's how I get in the short term. And then long term, it's very similar in the term of long-term goals, but it also requires that whoever is guiding them also checks in on it, because I don't think buy-in can, in many cases, I don't think buy-in can, how can I say this in not Denglish? I'm sure you guys are in the same boat. It's almost 9 o'clock at night and I'm thinking, German, English. How do I get this to come out in one language? It's hard for buy-in to hold over time, right? Like motivation goes in waves. It's totally normal that motivation fluctuates throughout the lifespan. That's completely normal.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's important that the guide who's there always reminds them that they have small steps and big steps, so that when the big steps get too out of reach, they're too unrealistic, they're too far away. You know, we talk already this year about, do we delay the Olympics again? Or do we just wait for another 3 years? Like, what do we do at this point? It's really hard for an athlete to be like, I don't know what I'm going to play again, so why should I keep training?
Yeah.
So to help them, my job is basically to help them keep perspective of, yeah, maybe the long-term goal is this, but you're also bought into doing this tiny thing in this training session because you want to change that and move that threshold forward. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of interesting bullet points you just mentioned. While I was preparing for this podcast, I was thinking, you know, athletes that consult you and come to you and ask you if they could train with you, you know, that's obviously a different situation than the situation I face, because I'm in a team setting. I'm there. You know, they cannot pick me, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what I wanted to ask, do you agree that if an athlete comes to you and wants to work with you, that getting buy-in is maybe a little bit, I won't say easier, maybe yes, when somebody comes to you and, you know, wants to train with you and is willing, for example, is willing to pay you to train with you, is that, you think that's easier for you?
What I don't know if it's easier or harder. We can get to that in a minute. I think what it definitely does do is, for me, because I'm external when I work with athletes in that sense, it takes away the head coach and it takes away the context that you have to work in all the time, and can make things extremely difficult to get buy-in, because oftentimes we're clashing with the head coach, or we clash with the medical staff, or we clash with other players. When I'm just working with a small group of athletes who come to me themselves as an external person, it's a lot different than working with, you know, my team of 23 guys here in Vizek, who are always here with both of the coaches and, you know, the Leistungsdirektor from the academy. So it's definitely a different context. I don't know that it's easier or harder, but it does take out a huge step of the influence. I would say, though, monetary or financial motivation is not the only thing. I definitely have seen a lot of people financially contribute to, oh, I want to get better, and then be like, well, it was only this much money. It doesn't, especially when you're working with the pros, they can afford to basically throw that money into the wind, out the window of the car and on the Autobahn, and just not ever think about it again. And so financial rewards can only go so far, especially because I don't think that in buy-in, the external financial reward is helpful. Like, it needs to be intrinsic. They need to be at some level intrinsically motivated. And so having that external motivator of, but you're paying for it, but you're paying for it. How long can we talk about money? That's basically all we talk about in sports anyway. So no, I've definitely met some really lazy people who will throw a lot of money at me, and some really, really motivated, tough guys, who have nothing to pay.
And I think that, like, goes with what you said earlier about the responsibility. Like, you're not going to take the responsibility for the athletes. Like, they cannot pay you to, like, reach their goals. It's in the end, like, you can help them, but in the end, they have to do it. I think, like, that's something I wanted to get at, and you said, like, within the first two sentences, so.
I think I have definitely had a lot of privilege in the sense of, I usually come from things as an external person, and so I get to come into a team and basically say, I've never not been in a situation where I can't come into a team and say, if you're not going to train, I'm not going to baby you, go home. Like, even with my guys in Vizek, if you're not going to come in the Kraftraum and actually work out, if you're just going to be annoying or just, you know, do some bullshit around the room and be distracting, then you can go home, because I'm not your parent, you don't pay me, I didn't birth you, and I refuse to. And so you can just leave if you're going to cause a problem. It doesn't matter to me. And a lot of the times, the first time that comes out of my mouth, it corrects itself like that, because nobody really expects somebody, for especially me, I'm a relatively small female with a very loud voice, to look at them through my glasses and say, I don't care if you stay or leave. You know, I wish you would stay and I wish you would shape up, but if you don't, go home, because you're being a baby and you're being distracting, and come back when you actually want to train. And usually the next time they shut their mouth and come back and train. But again, that's a huge privilege that I have, because I'm not often employed just by the clubs themselves, where you do have to do a bit more parenting. I don't like to be a parent.
Dom, is that something you could do, you think?
Yeah, you did. I think I wouldn't be able to do that. To be perfectly honest, no chance that I could do it. And, you know, in my situation, yeah.
You're working with professionals, so that's difficult.
That's, yeah, exactly. It's difficult, but I also like it. I actually really like it. So in regards to buy-in, I think my situation is just a little different, of course. Most of the time, you get like a lot of new players every season. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a lot. I mean, what does a lot mean? Let's say 5, 6, 7 new players. And for me, obviously, I have to start from scratch almost always every season. Yeah, if I have guys for multiple years, that's obviously easier. I know their history. I know what they like. It's way easier to connect with me. It's way easier to connect to them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But let's say if I have new players coming in, for example, this year we have a relatively new team. Mm-hmm. I have to start from scratch. Yeah. And in order for me to get buy-in, Yeah, I personally think there are like certain character traits that can lead to buy-in.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm not sure if I'm right or wrong, but things like being reliable, being empathetic, being enthusiastic about what you do, passionate, of course. I think in the long run, during the season, that obviously helps in order to get the players listening to me.
Do you think that those are things that lead to buy-in or things that are associated with people who have buy-in?
It depends on the person, of course. Huh? I mean, I think it also leads to buy-in. It just takes time. I mean, that's at least my experience. And then there are also other things that I consider very important. You know, these are like certain demands I have to myself. You know, mm-hmm. I want to be structured. I want to be prepared. You know, there's like, for example, I always keep telling myself, when the players come in, I don't want to set up anything anymore. I want it to be set up by then. You know, mm-hmm. You probably can imagine time is always an issue, especially in professional sports. And you know, if you just think about it, we should think, man, yep, they're professionals. We should have enough time, right?
Never. But
no, we never have. And that's why I think all these things, if you really want to make training, let's talk about lifting weights. If you really want to make that work, you need to use the time that you have as best as possible. And then if these things add up, you know, if players realize, and then obviously, you know, I want to explain my philosophy. They should see that I have a philosophy. They should see that I'm invested in their progress, of course. And these are all things that add up. And then I always try to look for one-to-one like conversations with them, you know, want to trigger their interest if they're not interested already. And then they're, you know, players are so different these days. Players sometimes know more than I do about certain topics,
yeah?
Which is great. Yeah. And then you have players, they have never heard about, like, I don't know, whatever you call it, like doing a good deadlift, for example, you know, and that's, there's so much differences in players, and that's why I think all these things matter in the course of the season, you know. And if I can establish myself, if they realize that this guy sort of knows what he's doing, I think that mm-hmm. helps.
I think I could add to your experience with my experience in college as well, is I determined pretty early there's two ways that I can go as a new coach coming in, because I'm usually a new coach coming into an older team.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to bring it up, but it's a huge part of it as a woman as well. It takes a while to earn respect mm-hmm. from male teams, especially in baseball, basketball, American football. And here in Germany, of course, soccer is the dude sport, and you have to kind of break in a bit because it's an old boys club to some extent. And I realized quite early on, and that's part of the reason why I do the whole if you're going to be a baby, then go get in your cradle kind of thing, mm-hmm. is because it usually takes about 6 weeks for me to earn the respect as a professional, or mm-hmm. it could take me 2 hours because I'll be a bro with them. So I can be a bro with them and earn a little bit of respect and fit in with them really fast, or I can hold out and be professional about it and then earn their respect as a professional. So it's like the bro versus pro mentality. And I kind of have to find mm-hmm. the sweet spot between being too rigid and saying immediately, I'll kick you out if you don't behave, or treating somebody like they're being dumb because they're being rude during a training session the first time, versus, you know, being too relaxed and being too buddy-buddy with them to the point where they don't even listen to me in training sessions anymore. So having to find the middle with that, and a part of that being I won't take responsibility for their buy-in, but I will definitely take the responsibility for me being on time, being organized, having their best interests at heart, that my values are always their health over their performance, that I'll advocate for them, that I specifically care about them, that I know their names, that I know their injury history, that when I take their data, I specifically go to them and ask, you know, when their wellness questionnaire comes back and says, how are you doing, scale of 0 to 10? Yeah, it's a 2 and it's been 2 for 3 weeks. I'm going to talk to you about it because I need to know how you're doing. And I care about that. And if I can do something to help you, then I want to do that, or empower you to go do it yourself so that I can, help you get better, advocate for you. That's really important to me. So I think at least in my experience, when athletes realize, regardless of the level, hey, you're not just my buddy, but you're also not my head coach. You're not my strict headmaster. I don't have the ability to kick them out of the team. I can send them home from a training session, but I can't kick them off the team and cut their paycheck or whatever. And that I hold myself to just a high as standard as I expect from them, that I'm bought into the training and that I'm doing it for their health and not just because I want the money from their performance or the fame for their performance. I don't put myself in the front. That has always worked quite well.
Earlier you mentioned also that you want intrinsic, or you like the athlete to be intrinsically motivated. I think I have mentioned that quite a lot of times on the podcast. What I found out that helped me quite well the last years. What I always do in the weight room when we lift, I give options, autonomy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, options.
Yeah, sure.
Like within a structure, though. Yeah. Of course, not everybody is doing their own training, of course. But I would like to get your opinion on that. What do you think of that?
Definitely. I especially for my athletes who now are stuck in the house or in bubbles or whatever, I love giving them things like, I need you to do an upper body pull. You have these 10 exercises to choose from, for example. And they can basically, I build the program, but they get to do the exercise selection to a certain extent. Or, I need you to do this long of a run or this much conditioning. You can choose what form you want to do. If you want to do tempo sprints, if you want to do bike tempos, if you want to do this, that, or the other thing. So they have that feeling of autonomy as well. I do think that's really important.
That's very good to hear, because, you know, I also have the feeling that it just works. You always have players, you know, who don't like to be in the weight room.
Yeah.
And if you then give them choices, I always have the feeling, yeah, then at least they pick something and then they just do it like with a better intensity, yeah, or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that works quite well, especially in a team setting. For example, it's tough for me to have some sort of a periodization. I think in the end, it matters that you lift,
yeah,
twice, three times a week, you know, whatever the schedule allows us to do.
But it is also so hard to fit a program that's competent in there.
Exactly. And then there are like so many variables you have to account for. You know, then this one player is sick, is not here today. Mm-hmm. The other guy just feels completely depleted because practice was hard.
And now this player has been in quarantine because he had to travel there. So he lost 2 weeks. Now you got to start all over with him. Or now this player has to go out on the pitch and I don't have him for training when I was supposed to have him for 45 minutes and I had him for four, you know? So it's a mess. I totally understand what you mean. But for me, autonomy has another role as well. And that is, again, for me, it's about the health of the athletes always. Mm-hmm. And that also means, mm-hmm, after they retire, I want them to take something with them. I don't want them to stop training. I don't want them to stop playing. I don't want them to stop moving. And I know a lot of these, especially youth football players, soccer players that I have here, when they're 18 and they don't get a contract, they'll be done. They won't play football again. They won't get in the Kraftraum again or into the gym. They won't do anything. Maybe they'll go running here and there, but they'll probably be injured, have a shot ego or a bruised ego. And I want them to take something with them. And that includes for me understanding what health is, what speed is, what strength is, what conditioning is. And so being able to give them, I need you to do an upper body pull today. Yeah, what's that? Think about it. This is your upper body. And for those of you who are listening, you can't see, but on video, I'm showing them, you know, my arm. This is my upper body. And I have my arm over my head and I'm going to pull it down. Oh, so like a pull-up. Yeah, that would be an example of an upper body pull. What would be something else? To get them to really think through, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? You know, not with every exercise. That gets irritating after a while. But it is important that, you know, once a week I ask, hey, and what is this exercise for? What do you think this improves on the court or on the field? And then they get to answer, you know, what they think it improves. Yes or no. Oh, that improves my sprint. Oh, that'll improve my dunk. That'll improve my vertical, whatever. So that they can take those little nuggets with them and say, oh yeah, I remember in the weight room when we did a single leg deadlift and that helps my, the first 5 meters of my sprint, it helps my stability. It helps me stand on one leg, etc. That's really important because they're not going to take a lot of the sport specific stuff with them into retirement.
Yeah, that's a good way of getting, yeah, education across, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you already said it, like the way you word stuff, we hear that you work a lot with soccer players. That's where you also come from. Mm-hmm. And in this podcast, we talked a lot of, or a lot with the perspective of being on the basketball court. Mm-hmm. So when I talk to Dom and we talk off this topic, like, and sometimes we watch soccer, like sometimes
it's a little bit different than basketball.
it's different. Exactly. Like, it's definitely different. The way they need to perform is different. So obviously different
needs. Yeah. Physical qualities. Leads,
exactly. Need to be trained. And something that Dom always gets mad at, and like after a while, like working with him, talking to him, I understand, like when he hears, and I feel like with soccer players, maybe I'm like biased now, but I hear this a lot, like in warm up they would pull like a muscle or something, or like getting subbed in, and like always they pull a muscle, like the hamstring is the classical one, where I'm like, what the fuck are they doing?
Or just like a low-key Fußgelenk Bänderriss in training camp. And it's like, guys, we haven't even made it to Testspiel yet. How are you out here pulling an ankle?
Exactly. Like, and this seems that, and like this happens in German Bundesliga, where I'm like, man, what the fuck
are you kidding me? How many athletes do they have to send home from national team camp literally every single at every single training camp, just because in a Testspiel or in a training session, they rolled an ankle one time or popped a knee. And it's like, bro, this is so embarrassing. Yeah. This is so embarrassing.
So maybe, so kind of two questions go with this. But first, maybe the one that we're already making fun of soccer players. Why or how does it come that they're like, seem to be, it seems, just looking from the outside, I have no clue, I have no insights, like this needs to be said, but it seems to me from the outside, like, what are they doing sometimes? Do they have like a Kraftraum, or like
no,
is it just not there? Like
yeah,
why do you think is that, Mela? That's a big question, but let's maybe start with the first one.
I'm going to try and keep my shit talk to a minimum because I've been trying to be really nice to Germans and to the DFB lately. God is still working on me. I'm still in the middle. I'm not good, but I'm not as bad as I used to be. And in the States, the big focus that we've always had is an athlete, creating a complete athlete, a fast athlete, a strong athlete, a physical athlete. And you notice that American the technical and tactical side in most American sports is not that good. And that's just because Germans grew up and most Europeans grew up with the ball on their feet or the ball on their hands, whatever, and just played intuitively. But they didn't have, at age of 8 years old, they weren't getting stuck in a strength and conditioning or in physical education at school where there were weights, things like that. So here, where there's a lot of natural early specialization because of street football, and that's just is the thing to do, they're more technically and tactically advanced in Germany. And that has always held out until the last about 10 years. And we started to notice, especially in women's football around 2009, that the Germans are getting their ass beat now because they're not athletic and they're technically and tactically superior in every way. But now the other teams are starting to get athletic and technically and tactically superior. So what do we do about that? And the athletic training thing hasn't really caught on. Somehow they skipped actual strength and conditioning and went to neuroathletic training. Not really sure how, because they've been telling us for 5 years that they don't have any money to pay actual strength and conditioning staff or put actual athletic trainers on the national teams, you know, where you would think that they would actually have athletic staff, but they don't.
I remember in 2006, they actually did it for the World Cup. And? Jürgen Klinsmann, he like got Verstegen and whatever, and like it was a big hype. The media got onto him.
Remember
for,
all
like,
the
doing
bands?
That.
They had mini bands.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Where did all that go?
Well, and and think about this year in Corona lockdown, in the first one, everybody's like, oh my god, all the Bayern Spieler players are jacked now. What were they doing? They were all working out the whole time. Yeah, because they were in the Kraftraum because they weren't allowed to leave. So now they're jacked, and they were brutal last season, and everybody got their ass beat. So why isn't everybody in the strength and conditioning now? It's amazing. Yeah. But at the moment in German football, we're just consistently fighting against the concept of this is how we've always done it. So it's how we will continue to do it, because how we've always done it clearly doesn't work anymore. It works for a long time, again, because they were so technically and tactically so good. But everybody else is now technical and tactical too, and way faster and getting injured way less.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's something, you know, we people in general, us humans, mostly don't like to do, like change stuff.
Yeah, it was a routine. It worked for 50 years. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, yeah.
And to pinpoint it more specifically, in my experience, yes, it's the strength training, but a lot of it is that in training, in German soccer, I always want to say German football, but I'm sure there's internationals listening. In German soccer, we don't have maximal sprinting in training. We're going to do conditioning, and that's usually 10 by 1,000 meter sprints. How you can sprint 1,000 meters, I'm not really sure. I know that that strength and conditioning coach has never actually done it himself, because that's not a sprint training. That's a run. Mm. That's a middle distance run. With, you know, because it's repeated sprintability, it's 10 times 100 meter sprint with 60 seconds rest, because we want RSA. And that's not how you train either of those things. And so then when they have a 10 meter sprint or a 30 meter sprint and they pop a hamstring in training because suddenly they're maximal sprinting and they're not used to having 6 times body weight on one leg because they run 10 times 1,000 meters or a kilometer, it suddenly doesn't work anymore. And that is just key for injuries. So for me, it's the mixture of ditch the Stabis, ditch the neuro stuff, do actual lifting. And once you have your Grundausdauer, go sprint like maximally. And if you not sprinting is not sprinting. If you're not sprinting maximally, then you're not sprinting. And that's what we do in football. And the research tells us now that soccer is a middle distance sprint sport. So we need to be maximally sprinting because that's what we do the most. We literally repeatedly sprint for the entire game for 90 minutes. And the fastest team is going to win. Whoever gets there first. Like, sorry, I don't care how conditioned you are if you cannot get to the ball. Because whoever gets there first will win. That was long-winded. Like I said, I get really worked up about German football because it's just like talking to a concrete wall. But here we are.
No, you know what? I actually wanted to ask you anyway, because you just talked a lot about training. This is like one thing I also, right now, you know, think a lot about, like, what is actually good training? What defines that? Yeah. What is your take on that? And then maybe afterwards I give you mine. Maybe I think we will have some
similarities.
Yeah, we have the same thoughts. Yeah. Let's see.
For me, good training is the minimal dose that gets the maximum adaption. So if I can give you the absolute minimum that you need to change for the better and to move your threshold towards more fitness, to more strength, to more speed, to a better performance, then that's the correct amount of training. It's literally as simple as that. And what that needs is, my basic formula is, when I'm working with an athlete, it doesn't matter the sport. I work with all sports. It just happens to be right now in my life, it's primarily ice hockey and soccer. I look at the sport and the demands of that sport specifically, and then we look at the athlete and subtract that from the demands of the sport, and that gives us basically what they don't have, what they're lacking, whether that's speed, whether that's strength, whatever. All right, so the sport is demanding that from you, and we know that you only have this. So we work basically down to their, or I work, my company works down to their basic physiology and says, okay, you need more speed. So what do we need to give you to make sure that you get that speed? So now you're meeting the demands of that sport. And that's the whole equation. So I just give them just enough of that speed work, that strength, that conditioning to get their baseline up to where it's meeting the demands of the sport, hopefully exceeding the demands of the sport. And that's enough training. I don't need to give them more of that. I don't need them to be sore. I don't need them to be in pain. They don't even have to sweat. If they can do it without sweat, more power to them. It's literally just enough to get the physiological adaption so that they move forward and can meet the demands of their sport more efficiently. That's a super sciencey answer. I hope it makes sense.
No, I love it. I love it. Also the minimum or minimal effective dose kind of thing.
Exactly. If I can make you sprint 1 times 30 meters and we achieve the goal with that and you become faster because you sprinted 1 times 30 meters, we only have to sprint 1 time. That's it.
Yeah. I like to always put that in an image because I think sometimes people just don't understand what that means.
Mm-hmm.
There's like the good example, let's say if you have a headache, you know, you don't want to take 5 pills. You want to hopefully only take one and that the headache goes away. That's sort of like a little bit comparable to the minimal effective dose.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, if you asked me now, I was about to do it, Dom.
What's good training to you, Dom?
Just ask yourself, it sounds better.
I've been talking about that lately a little bit more often. I just want to say it as simple as possible. Lift something heavy in the weight room. Lift it with max intent. Move something relatively light very fast.
Yeah.
Move your body very fast. Mm-hmm. So sprinting. And then you need to do something that puts you in a position that you can withstand the load on the court for whatever sport you do. And I think that sums it up quite well.
Yeah.
If you do this, obviously needs to be regular and progressive, then I think you're on a good way.
Yeah, I agree. Big fan of all those things.
Nice. So maybe this would be a great start to like go into your other expertise of like the mental part of the game, the psychology behind it, maybe. Yeah, maybe like a good question to start with is what do you feel like you worked a lot with athletes already. Mm-hmm. What do you feel like, or what are the usual issues that say they come to you with? Like, what makes them, like, let's just say their body is like perfect, nutrition is perfect, if there was ever a perfect, but like that all works, but they can still not get their performance on the pitch, on the court, or whatever. Like, what do you think are the main factors that they somehow cannot like get it to go?
There's two things that come first to my mind, so I'll just say them both, and that's the mental chatter, the self-talk that they have in their heads with themselves, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and the complete inability to manage stress. Mm-hmm. And athletes are brilliant because, and I love working with them from a psychological, or as a psychologist, because they have so many intuitive stress management strategies and performance strategies, and the way that they like develop their own coping mechanisms throughout their life. But as a psychologist, I also think about it from like, I'm not a psychotherapist yet, so but I think about it from a psychotherapeutic perspective of everybody develops coping mechanisms in their life throughout the lifespan based on what they are undergoing at the time that they need that coping mechanism. But then things change. So even if it was helpful at the time that it was developed, things have often changed beyond that, so they need something different that's not meeting the need anymore, or that coping mechanism was maladaptive or negative to begin with and actually took away from their performance, but filled the need that they had or soothed the stress that they were feeling in that moment, but it was maladaptive and had worse effects on their performance. So think about like if a young athlete's coach, for example, always said that he was a terrible athlete. He was slow, lazy, and would never make it. So he started saying to himself first, I'm slow, lazy, and I'll never make it. Because if he said it first, then it didn't hurt so bad when his parents and his coach said it. And now he's in the U21s or whatever, and he's still saying that to himself. And now he's got mind chatter. So every time he goes to take a penalty kick, he's always thinking in his head, you suck and you'll never make it. Even though that was his way of making it when he was 8.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So a lot of my job is, again, I'm not a sports psychologist. I don't have that Riesenausbildung. I don't have that that study program on top of me. I'm just a normal psychologist. Is often just talking about where did that come from, because that'll usually get us to the bottom of where a lot of our patterns come from. So where did that come from? How did it develop? What was the original situation? And how can we adapt that now to make it more beneficial to where you are, and who you want to be? And so when athletes struggle with stress, a lot of times it's a lack of sleep, a lack of proper food, the not recognizing the fact that there's always external factors at play. Like, you don't come to the pitch and just leave your bags of, the breakup you had last week, the exam you're going to have next week, yeah, your parents being irritating, your car broke down, financial trouble, whatever. You don't just leave that in the car when you go train or you go play. It's always with you and it's always in the back of your mind, even if you're not consciously thinking about it. So a lot of the stuff we work on is just identifying what they're already using and improving what's already there, which is our job as a strength coaches anyway. So I think that sports science and psychology go so well together because we're always just working with what we've got and improving that, optimizing that, and giving them new strategies for, okay, how can you let part of those things, like let some of those things go? Like, how can we minimize the stress and not just not think about it? How do we actually take away the stress? How do we actually manage stress? And once you start managing stress, a lot of times that mind chatter will calm down as well. Mm-hmm. And helping them become friends with the mind chatter. I'm not a big fan of being like, oh, you have to talk positively to yourself. You know, only positive self-talk is the good thing. And the research doesn't even say that the positive self-talk is the only good thing. You know, research tells us also that negative self-talk in some senses can be beneficial. And that was always my problem as well. I was the worst to me as an athlete. But it actually helped. And so teaching athletes that mind chatter is, one, completely normal. And two, it's probably always going to be there. And three, if you just make a seat for it and stop trying to counteract it the whole time, you're going to have a lot more energy and a lot more mental real estate because you're not going to be fighting with yourself internally. And that mind chatter is literally telling you that you've lost before you've even gotten out of the car to warm up. So stop focusing on the mind chatter of, I suck, I'm never going to make it, I'm this, that, and the other thing. Let it talk and stop trying to combat it. And the less that you fight it, usually the less it becomes as well. The quieter it gets, the less focused you are on it. And you can now focus on the process instead of just the outcome because your brain is telling you you've already lost before you've even gotten to start.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so much, so much good stuff.
I'm a psychologist, so I like to rant a lot.
Yeah. But something I really liked and that I think is really important that you said, or like giving the athlete the feeling of like you had your really good reasons of having this maybe bad self-talk, let's say. Like,
totally.
Like it's like from early childhood or like first coaches or whatever.
And it helped you like, then. Yeah.
Exactly. And like that's when I feel like when at my job, when I talk to like people trying to find their way in jobs and like finding the way, like just letting them know that they're perfectly or like it makes sense for them to be that way, even if they maybe don't even like that part in them that's there, like just give, and then they like open up emotionally, like immediately, basically, like maybe that's like the buy-in on the, let's say, psychological side. So and something I think really important there is like the it's tough for me to put this in English, but yeah, basically the language you work with, you know, like the way you put it, like sometimes I feel like people like, and that's also with performance coaches or whatever, like when you come and I'm like, I'm the dude, like I know it all. I studied this, I did that. And like, I worked with this guy and this worked. So if you do this, it's perfect. And have fun in life. Yeah. Like it's not that easy, but maybe you could give us your take on like how to talk to athletes that they can actually open up to you and like you can get to the bottom of things.
Yeah, talk to them like they're normal. I don't know. For me, it's weird because I've worked with athletes who are Olympians at the highest international level and then like the worst recreational league athletes, and they all get treated the same. Like I said, if you are throwing a fit and you don't want to listen, you'll still be asked to clean up your act. It doesn't matter if you got a gold medal at the last Olympia or whatever. It doesn't matter to me. To me, you're my athlete right now. And I'm going to work as hard for the recreational athlete as I will for the Olympian. And I expect the rec athlete to give me 100%, just like I expect the Olympia to give me 100%. And so I treat them like they're completely normal, and I listen to them like they're completely normal, and I show a really, like, I am genuinely interested in all of my athletes. I'm super normal with them. I treat them like they're super normal, and I just listen. Like, I just ask questions that require them to answer them, and not like yes or no. And I search for ways to make a connection with them. So like I said, whether it's the educational piece, whether it's the, what does this exercise do? What do you think? Or, the autonomy, or hey, your wellness score, I saw that this, that, or the other thing, how can I support you? I always make it about how can I help you? You know, tell me what's going on. How can I help you? I'm here for you when you need that. Instead of, hey, what's going on? You need to tell me this, that, or the other thing about why you're so stressed out all the time. So I open the door for them to come to me while making small connections that aren't specifically about super serious topics, like, hey, how's your depression today? Like, it doesn't need to be that serious. I'm always very respectful with space, because as a psychologist, obviously we work confidentially. And so I never just in the middle of the Kraftraum with 20 other guys go up to them and be like, hey, I saw your wellness score shit today and you're super stressed out. And what's going on? How can we help? I always am very discreet about it. And I just try and slowly open doors across time so that when they're ready, they know that I'm present and available and I will listen and not just give. And I'll actually listen for comprehension and not just listen to answer the question.
Yeah. And the confidentiality part, have you had, like, the way sometimes I imagine, like, for example, when you get hired as a psychologist from a team, let's say, it's probably because the head coach or some other guy or girl thinks this is important, so we do this now. Yeah. And, like, they want to enhance performance and whatever the reasons they have with this, like, do they want, or do they try to get information from you, or are they like immediately like, okay, you do your thing, let's say, to like keep it very simple, or are they like asking, like, how does this work in the praxis?
I have definitely had situations where the coaches want and expect information from me afterwards, and I am always excruciatingly clear in the first meeting and repeat over and over again. I always work on a confidentiality basis. I work for the athletes in this case. I don't work for you. We can definitely work together. I work with a lot of coaches, actually, and then that will always also stay with me confidentially. I won't tell the athletes that we even worked together, anything like that, but I'm also not going to tell you which athletes came to me for what they're struggling with. Like, I'm not the strength coach who will report back the numbers for the week, or the doctor who's going to give you the medical numbers. Like, you will hear nothing from me. And then if they try and pull information, or you know how it is when you just are asking, oh, I saw you were meeting with this person, you know, how's that going? How's he doing? And it can be difficult to be like, are you trying to get information, or are you actually genuinely curious? Whatever. I'm always over careful with, again, I'm there for the athletes and their health, and not for the performance and not for the club. Because I'm clear with that from the beginning and generally work as an external, it's usually been okay. But it can definitely be tricky at times because, again, coaches want to know everything. And it's difficult to have somebody who you can't be like, tell me this now. Or I need to know this information now. You know, why won't my players tell me this? And they're telling, why do they need a psychologist to tell this to? Why can't they tell me this? What's going on? And when is it going to get better? I totally understand why that can be difficult for coaches, but it's legally binding for psychologists to hold confidentiality. But it's also really important for the athletes.
Yeah, for sure.
There's Leonard, sorry for interrupting. In regards to your question earlier, I didn't want to interrupt Julia while she was ranting. there's one thing I also always think about as a coach when you speak to players. I think you have to be authentic. Yeah, I think that helps a lot.
Sure.
And you should always try to tie an investment to a possible outcome, I think. You know what I mean? You have to put stuff within the reach of players that will also help in getting them listening to you, I think.
Yeah, when it's realistic. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Needs to be, you know, because I think committing to something, committing to change, always includes a little bit of inconvenience for a player. Huh? And you want to make that inconvenience as small as possible, I think. Well, that was just...
Yeah. Yeah, and something... Let's say, I was about to say something I like to do, but this is obviously not true. This is from like my, I picked this up, or I'm trying, that's the better word. I'm trying to pick this up from my mentor, and the way he like tries to work with athletes, like he created this online tool like years ago where he tries to like to put it, like we had in earlier episodes, Chris Sengfelder, the player, Bamberg player, he was a guest, and he like before the podcast, he played this tool, and then they got together and talked about like the results, and basically, it tries to like measure how your frontal lobe works, let's say, and what kind of coping mechanisms, that's something you talked about earlier, they have to like solve problems basically. And what he like, that's what I was aiming at also with like the language part. Like he never tells him, oh, the tool said this, so you're acting like this. And then, because then athletes or just humans in general immediately like say, oh no, I'm not this way. This is not like, they start building up walls.
Yeah.
Walls.
Or think, oh God, there's something wrong with me, which is the last thing we need them to think.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And the way like he found a way of like offering this like more, let's say in stories, like he's working a lot with stories, like people having this competencies usually tend to act this way
or
tend to act that way. Yeah, exactly. And then he's just like offering this, and then they like, you see them like they go most like inside and really like listen to them, and then they like say, ah, oh, yeah, I can see myself, and yeah, this is that, blah blah blah. And that's something like he works with a lot. And yeah, I don't know where I was trying to head with this point, but that's just something I wanted to add.
Yeah, that makes sense, because it makes it less personal for the athlete, and that they can identify themselves with it. And here's a little coaching and psychology tip. We always want to make sure that it feels for the athlete like it was their idea. And that's often how we get investment from them, is when they came up with it, even if we fed it to them directly without saying it, like in this case, oftentimes it works so well with, ah, I have a light bulb moment. And it's like, yes, exactly. I've been telling you that for the last 3 weeks, but I'm glad that you've came to it, because now that it's your idea, something's going to happen.
There we are with buy-in again, same thing, basically.
But we know from therapy research as well, that if they can't identify it themselves, accept it and want to change, then we have no chance of changing it. So really the athletes who can see that in themselves and come up with those ideas, whether we fed it to them or not, those are the ones who are most apt to interact with us and change or try to. Psychology is really fun, man. And strength coaches and sports scientists and psychologists have a lot in common, but we fight with each other all the time. And I'm not really sure why, because we do each other's jobs basically all the time.
We crossfeed from each other basically, it's just all connected.
And strength coaches are frontline psychologists anyway, because we pick up all of the shit that happens in the weight room, all of the gossip, all of the, oh, I have problems with this, oh, I didn't sleep, oh, I broke up with my girlfriend, whatever it is. We pick all that up in the weight room, and then psychologists have so much to do with load management data, for example, that we need to work directly with the strength coaches and the sports scientists in order to have a complete team. So that's really important. Mm.
What data are you working with from a psychological standpoint?
At the moment, we're just doing wellness questionnaires, unless I need to do like diagnostics with a specific player who's coming to me specifically for psychology work or a consultation. So we use the wellness questionnaire that we use is based off of Hoffenheim's questionnaire. Tiski, theirs is all in like app form, because of course they have all the cool tech stuff and we're poor over here. We're like, the TSG VZEC is like the broke version of Hoffenheim. So we have a couple of questions. It's sleep quality and quantity. We have mood, stress, pain, soreness. I always differentiate between the two, because it's also important for me that they can differentiate between that. Overall feeling, motivation, nutrition. And there's one more that I'm forgetting. But that's the general concept. Fatigue. I want to know how tired they are. And as a psychologist, then I can look at that and say, hey, sports scientist, is this, or to myself, hey, other Julia, sports scientist Julia, is this adding up? Is this adding up with how you periodize? Like, should I be expecting that they're all sore right now? Should I be expecting that they're all fatigued right now? Like, are we peaking at the moment? Do I need to deload the athletes? Is this adding up? I can kind of look and see if this is based on the program that we're doing right now and the phase that we're in our load, if I need to adjust that, or if this is just player specific and there's something else kind of hanging over specific players, or if they're all just in a bad mood right now. You know, it's not very often that they're all just in a bad mood. It usually has something to do with what we're doing to them and with them. So then it's time for when the data numbers get to be a little bit off, then it's time to sit down with the coaches and say, hey, even if we feel like this is great, something isn't working with the athletes and their physiology and nervous systems are ultimately what guide our programs. So we need to have a look at this.
Do you feel like there is a change going on in the sports world, maybe in general, or in soccer world, that there's like more talk about the psychological part of the game, or like the, and also maybe the need for help, let's say, for psychologists?
Yes, because finally we have research. we knew that before from athlete anecdotes, but now that research findings are coming out, which research is usually done 10 years after it's in the practice, right? We know that from strength and conditioning. It's usually the research proves what's already been being done. So now, great, we know that that works. We always knew it works. It's pretty much the same for psychology at the moment. Realizing what works, what's effective, what's not, and that mental health is a really big topic in sport at the moment, and it should be, it always has been, and that realizing that athletes struggle with it and then don't have the resources to deal with it, like they're not offered consultants, they're not offered psychologists or therapists, anything like that. How do we get that to them? Because it's a key proponent of health. And I think a lot of that has to do with the concussion conversation and former athletes with big names coming out and being like, yo, I was suffering, we need this. And unfortunately, also prolific suicides have a lot to do with that as well.
So one last thing I wanted to touch with the mental part of the game, let's say, is, and it's tough for me to put this, but what I'm trying to get at is like, probably when you started playing sports, it was probably as a kid. You mentioned this earlier with like German soccer players, or like they start really early and they just do it for the fun of the game.
Yeah.
Like they're really into it. They're like, oh my God, this works. This is awesome. Yeah. This is just fun. Like,
yeah.
And they don't do it for like performance and stuff. But then when they're talented, and now even earlier, starting with 13, 14, they get in touch with these performance, this performance like business even around, like you need to perform, you need to get better, and like this is where you could head, blah 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 blah. And like I feel like that, like the early, like it starts so early, but in the end, like that's holding them, or some athletes, not like some of them really can handle it well and they're like really good at it, but I think most of them, like that stops their creativity even from like the brain side. Like that's not how it's supposed to work. Like you cannot tell yourself perform better and then I perform better. Like you need to have fun at it, and that's how you get like new creative ways of finishing, of doing stuff. Like how do you see, like do you think there's a possible change in that? Because in the end it's all about wins. That's how the business side of this usually works when you want to go professional. But like how can you maybe still find your way and like keep these like let's say kids aspects of the game in you, like the fun?
Yeah, so deliberate play I really love. Like we know deliberate practice and deliberate play and training to play and training to train and all of those from long-term athletic development. You know, we've made this all a science as scientists tend to do. It's all in phases and systems. I genuinely think that if we can provide more resources to athletes that focus on their health, again, like having a psychologist, having a doctor, having a strength coach, having a sports scientist, where they don't have to go in to the Kraftraum and really think about it, where they have somebody that they can talk to if they need it, where they always have like people that they trust around, and where our focus is on their health so it's not adding more stress, more unnecessary volume, unnecessary training sessions and stuff on top of them. I think that that will help tremendously, because you can't have, and I say this to Stefan Dahl all the time and he agrees, so I'll have to say it here. You can't have a high performing athlete who isn't healthy. Like, occasionally there'll be a high performer who's just, you know, struggling with things mentally, or their body is sick, whatever, or they're overtrained, whatever, and they can perform to an extent. But to have long-term peak performance, you need a healthy athlete. So if we can focus on the health of the athletes and the human beings and develop them as such, and they like have a life outside of sport where they can actually not be an athlete for a while, and, you know, have a social life and have a family life and have a private life that, and that's actually like respected, and we expect them to go have it where they have a free morning or they have a free evening or they don't have to, you know, come in for unnecessarily testing, whatever. If we can take the load off of them and focus on their health and let them be human beings, they'll also perform better, because having
it comes with it.
It comes with it. Oh, we set them up for peak performance because we allowed them to be a complete athlete and a healthy human being. Wow.
Yeah,
but it doesn't work in
this
reverse.
It sounds so easy.
Yeah,
it sounds so easy. But then I see like head coaches like working with, well, you played bad today, so tomorrow extra practice.
Yeah, and,
like,
and now you have
like
to run.
Being hard on themselves, and like athletes are hard enough on themselves usually.
Yeah,
like they're really into it. Like they care a lot. And then like I see a lot of coaches working with like insults and stuff, and I'm like, this is. They're already insulting, their self-talk is already insulting them a lot. And like that keeps them down, and you're like just pushing it. There might be some athletes that don't care, and there you maybe go that road, but most, I don't think that's going to work.
Yeah, and the research that we've had coming out in the last couple of years as far as mental health in athletes, and a couple of the studies that I've read, not covering all of the research, obviously, but if I remember correctly, the two major concerns and struggles with anxiety and depression were from coach feedback and fear of losing a contract or having to move to another league, like losing your sponsorships and your contracts. So
status,
money, and problems with the coach and like in inner team turmoil. So again, if we could not focus so much on the athlete just earning us money and actually giving them the resources to live as a human being, that would take so much load off their shoulders to just be like, huh, this time, you know, this 3 hours that I have now for my family is actually protected for my family. Like, I'm not using it better if I go out and run. That's wasting the time. Don't feel guilty about taking the time to sleep.
And the stuff you said, like what athletes actually care about, status, money, blah, blah, blah. Like most of the times we act, or the industry acts, like it doesn't exist. It's not there.
Yeah, because they've like, commoditized athletes. The athlete is just the product.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And when it's done, it can be thrown out. But that's not how we can treat human beings, because eventually they're going to retire, and then what do we do with them?
Yeah, and that's a sad story to end with, I guess, but that's...
No, because that's when their lives really start. They're not commodities anymore.
No, yeah, exactly. That for the athlete, yes, but like I'm talking from the perspective of the industry of like performance and stuff, like... I love to watch this. I love to be part of this. I love to be a fan. I love being a player and stuff. But this mechanism behind it really... Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we work in an industry that doesn't really value the person and rather the performance. And that unfortunately is how it has to be. But I always am very excited when one of my athletes I know is going to go leave and is going to have a better life now than they did before, because they were so stressed out and sick before. And it's like, I know that everybody thought that you were this huge status symbol and it was really awesome and whatever, everything that you were doing, but now you get to go on vacation. That sounds really awesome to me. I hope you love it.
Yeah. And it's great to me, like hearing you talk, I feel like you're a great addition to this, like you're in this cosmos of performances and stuff. And we need more people like you working in there, I think. And so that's how I kind of would want to wrap this up. Thanks a lot for like sharing your expertise. I think, Dom, this is a potential. We need a comeback. We need a comeback, I think, because there's so much more we could talk about. But I think this was already a lot of brain pops, at least for me personally. And I keep saying this, this podcast also has an intrinsic motivation for me, just like gaining some information for me and myself. So
well,
thanks for that.
since I stopped talking, it has been a brain popping, constant brain popping fireworks. Yeah. So
again, when the scientists start ranting, then. But I would put it like this: that the industry doesn't need more people like this. The sports world really needs athletes who can advocate for themselves on these specific topics. Right now, they need us for that. But I would love to live in a world where they don't need us for that, where we can just be the guides and we don't have to be the people speaking. Mm. So hopefully, whoever is listening to this got to take something away from it and can better advocate for themselves, because that's my goal for you. Thanks, guys, very much
great
for letting
me
come.
Yeah.
Leonard, we still have one more thing before we shut it down.
Yes, obviously.
What is your nomination?
My nomination is Maximilian Hilgertner, because he's one of my best friends, and he's also a physical therapist turned medical student, and he's going to be a great doctor for athletes, and he's already a great physical therapist for athletes and supporting them holistically as well. So I think he would be a great addition to this podcast. Last he was at the OSP Hessen, and now he's in Dresden studying. I think he would do nothing but contribute great things to this.
Awesome. Awesome. Oh.
I love you, Max. Come home, please. I miss working out in your basement and going partying with you. Enter, mom.
Yeah, we will definitely try to make this happen. And again, from our side, thanks a lot for taking the time. I think this was a great episode. It was a lot of fun for me, and I think for Dom also.
Oh, yes.
And I hope also for the listeners, aka the poppies. So this was it for me. Dom, you have the last words, I would say.
Thanks, Julia. Have a good night.
Sayonara, guys.
Poppies, we're not done yet. We're back.
You cannot get rid of us this easy.
Especially not of Leonard. No, but seriously, Leonard had a great idea. Would you like to explain that to us?
Yes, we want to start this, let's call it after show talk. After every episode, we want to talk about our personal brain pops we had, because we figured out that when I edit this and when I send it to Dom and you listen to it again, Dom, that we always, something different pops up than while recording it.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I mean, maybe I can only speak for myself, but while I'm recording, you know, even though we already recorded a few episodes, it's always an exciting situation. And I, not always, but most of the times, have the problem that I just don't get everything we're talking about. And if I listen to it after we recorded it, there are then so many situations where I'm like, damn, I didn't really get this while we were recording.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same here. It's not only you, so I can take that away from you. And I think, you know, that's just normal, that when you listen to it again, your mind will fill up something different with importance. And so we want to share these brain pops we have after our own work with you guys. And maybe this is also a way to get in touch with you guys more, to talk about the brain pops you guys have. But yeah, Dom, maybe you want to start with what popped up in your mind afterwards, after listening to this episode again.
Yeah, one thing I think that was in the second part of the show. That was your part, Leonard.
This is music to my ears.
But since we were talking about buy-in before, this is something, you know, I consider buy-in. That an athlete commits to change. That's for me sort of the basic, you know, idea behind buy-in. And she said something, I think, that wasn't really related particularly on to the topic of buy-in. But she said that athletes need to identify the value of certain things themselves to commit to change. So if they don't identify it themselves, there's basically no chance for change. So it needs to be intrinsic. Yeah. And that's something we know, of course, that once things are intrinsic, it will probably work out better. But before that, I think they need to identify the value of something themselves first. Because if they don't understand that certain things, I don't know, in my case, for example, sleep, nutrition, training, whatever, yield positive adaptations for performance, then change will probably not happen. And what I've said before many times on the podcast, then, you know, it asks the question, how do we do that as coaches, for example? And then I come back to, you know, first of all, I think it's education. Education needs to be there. Yeah. But if you just educate an athlete like with random facts, that's not going to do the trick. You know, that will probably not lead to the athlete committing to change. I think the education you offer needs to be digestible, of course, in a language that the athlete speaks. And it needs to be in the context to their environment. So then it hopefully leads to intrinsic motivation. Yeah. So, and once that happens, I think then change is not inconvenient anymore. That's something, I don't know, I was driving back to Bamberg. I was listening to it in the car, and that's something that really stood out for me. This, you know, that they have to identify it themselves first. And if they do, there's a very good chance that they maybe change something.
Mm. Yeah. And I think there's a lot that's going with that. First of all, like you said, the language you presented to them, and then also like the perspective you take. You know, yeah. If you're like talking from a high horse, yeah. You know, and I'm the expert, I know it all. That can work, but probably, you know, it's not going to be, like you said, intrinsic, and then it's not going to be, you know, change for the good, you know, for the long run. Exactly. And, you know, they will just, you know, and then also it goes with that you're like, basically, you're telling, like, if you're talking from a high horse, you're telling yourself that how good you know stuff, you know, how important this is, and you kind of hype yourself up, yeah.
Totally, yeah, that was my take, and I really liked it, because that's also the reason why we do this podcast. You know, it's a lot of fun for us, and I always come back to it. You can just learn so much from it. But yeah. Let's talk about your brain pop.
Yeah, my first, you know, while I listened to it, I was like, damn, my English is rusty. You know, and that kind of, you know, I got into my bad self-talk while listening to it. And that was also my biggest brain pop at the same time, because, you know, that's something she mentioned, that, you know, yourself, you're usually always the biggest critic of yourself. And that for sure also goes, you know, with the athletes. And, you know, the way this business and this industry around it is set up, you know, they even get more pressure, more criticism. You know, we talked about coaches and their role, and, you know, what tactics they sometimes try to use to get supposedly the most out of athletes. And, you know, I think, like I said, the athletes are their hardest critics. And, you know, in the end, you need like healthy and confident athletes to like really perform at the highest level possible for them. And it kind of goes hand in hand with what you said, like this motivation is intrinsic and it is there. And, you know, when they can get into this mode of just like trying to perform and trying to, you know, do what they do best and really believe in themselves mentally, and then you have like the body part, and then if you add that up, you know, those performances, those high performances just come by itself. And that was like kind of my biggest brain pop. And so.
Nicely said.
Yeah, thanks. And I kind of like this, you know, like this is like a week after we recorded. And I think this is something we should keep going. But, you know, first we got to see how the poppies like this, you know, how exactly. Our listeners like this. And maybe... they're like, yeah, no way, shut the up, and we don't want to, yeah, no. It's probably, you know, if you think that, you should not listen to this podcast, I guess. But maybe send, you know, anybody listening to this, send us your brain pops, because we really would like to get in a discussion with you guys, and, you know, this could be like a platform where we discuss more and get more into detail also with what you guys send us, you know. And yeah, I think the pre and after show talk could be something to get into this.
I agree. So, I also liked it a lot.
Awesome. So now we're really done. You really made it to the end of this episode. And hopefully you tune in again in 2 weeks. And Dom, I see you when we record next.
Exactly. And don't be so hard on yourself. Your English is good.
Yeah. And the first part you said for everybody else too. Don't be too hard on yourself.
Exactly.
Bye-bye, puppies.
Bye-bye.